Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. that the government does not want you to know. I think most of you listening to my voice listened to George Bush's inauguration speech, where he talked at length about freedom and democracy and liberty. In fact, he said the word freedom 27 times and the word liberty 17 times. He sure acted like he meant it. And I remember saying on this very show, on the very next day, I'm sure, in fact, that the president is not telling us the entire truth. I'm sure that he does not mean it with regard to our allies, such as Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And sure enough, there came the White House the very next day, within hours of my pronouncement on the radio, saying, yes, of course, George Bush does not mean freedom and democracy with regard to these close allies of the United States. They need to develop democracy in their own time. So how do we know when the president means it and when he does it? When does the United States intervene in a country and when does it not? I know I've had so many people, conservatives, come here, talk on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com, call into this radio broadcast and say, Saddam Hussein was a homicidal maniac. He was a genocidal dictator. And they're amazingly unaware of our support of Saddam Hussein in the 80s and the 90s. They don't know that we, the United States of America, funded Osama bin Laden to fight against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They don't realize how much of the trouble that happens around the world actually comes from American pockets. Well, one man does realize this, and in fact, he's got a real inside look at it. His name is John Perkins, and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, how the inside story of how America built an empire of third world debt, he's definitely an expert because he considers himself one of those corporate players that works secretly to, well, help control third world countries for America. Economic hitmen, John Perkins writes, quote, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. And how does John Perkins know so much about economic hitmen? Because he used to be one himself. And now he's coming here on the Inside Scoop to talk about his best-selling book. By the way, it's number 16 on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction, number 4 on the Amazon list, and more importantly, to tell us who are economic hitmen and what they're doing around the globe. So first, I want to welcome John Perkins to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let me start with, what is an economic hitman? Is this an expression that you made up, or is this one that others use as well?
Well, Mark, before I get into that, let me just say that the book is actually number 10 on the New York Times.
Oh, you've gone up some. Congratulations.
This week. It jumps around at that.
But good for you.
It's been on the list for several weeks now. And anyway, what is an economic hitman? Basically, we have been charged with the responsibility of building an empire, and since World War II, we've managed to create the first truly global empire in the history of the world.
When you say we, do you mean the United States? Do you mean economic hitmen?
I mean economic hitmen, basically.
Okay.
This empire is the quarterback of this empire, the CEO, if you will, is the United States. It certainly involves other countries, but we are the leaders. And it's an empire that's been built primarily by economic hitmen through economics, not with the military. This is the first in the history of the world.
Well, Mr. Perkins, did you develop this term economic hitmen, or do people secretly whisper this term and have for many years?
You know, I was recruited by the National Security Agency while I was still in college in 1968, and then they conducted a series of lie detector tests and other tests on me. To determine what my strengths and weaknesses were. And then I was trained by an amazing woman who's described in detail in the book, whose name is Claudine. And she's the one who first mentioned this term to me. And she kind of said, you know, it's a tongue-in-cheek term. It's sort of based on the mafia model of a hitman. My official title was economist, and then I was chief economist for a major consulting firm, Charles T. Maine, in Boston. I had several dozen people working for me, economists and financial experts, et cetera. So officially I was chief economist, but the tongue-in-cheek term was economic hitman. It's not a thing you run around the world telling other people that you do any more than a CIA spy runs around saying, I'm a spy or I'm a spook. He has another title, like, you know, political attaché or something like that.
Got it. Got it. But so this term has been around, I mean, do you know, is it 50 years old? Is it 100 years old?
Well, I first encountered it in 1970, actually, when she told me this term. So I don't know how long before that it was around.
Some 35 years ago. Now, you talk in your book about one of the main things that you economic hitmen do is you try to get third world countries to go in over their head, kind of like, I guess, what Bush is doing with our deficit here, to overspend on their credit cards, so to speak, take out really big loans for projects that they can't possibly pay back.
Yeah, that's sort of the most typical model. We do many different things, but I'd say if there is a typical model, it's that we identify a third world country that has resources we covet, like oil, and then we arrange for loans to that country from the World Bank or other affiliated banks. The money, most of the money from that loan never goes to the third world country. It goes to a company in the United States. We hear a lot these days about some of these companies like Bechtel and Halliburton. These companies then build big projects in that third world country, like power plants, industrial parks, ports, highways, things that primarily serve the very rich in the country. The rich in those countries get richer. The rich in our country get richer. But the country is saddled with a debt that it can't possibly repay. And so at some point in time, we go back to the country and say, look, you owe us a lot of money. You can't pay your debts. So sell our oil companies your oil at a real cheap price, allow us to build military bases in your country, vote with us on the next crucial UN vote, things like that.
Now, what you're suggesting, of course, is in the nature of what some people would call conspiracy. I mean, you're saying that the World Bank intentionally extends these loans knowing they can't be paid back. Am I right?
You're right in that, yes.
Okay. What evidence do you have? I understand they want that they extend these loans. What evidence do you have that the World Bank and others extend these loans knowing that they can't be paid back?
Well, I did it.
Okay.
It was part of my training, and we can look around now. I mean, you can see this all over the place. A country like Ecuador today, for example, owes roughly 50% of its annual revenues to paying off its debt service. Argentina has refused to do so. It's saying that this system that's been imposed upon it is basically illegal, and that it is not going to repay its debts. We've got a lot of countries that are saying they should not have to repay these debts. It is not, Mark, strictly speaking, a conspiracy, because a conspiracy, by definition, are a group of people plotting to commit an illegal act. The things that economic hitmen do are not technically illegal. They should be, but we write the international laws, and we've made sure that they're not illegal. Now, if we were to do this on a private level, if I were a banker and I went to you and I coerced or seduced you into accepting a loan that I knew full well you couldn't possibly repay, and I did this because I wanted to get a favor from you later on, that would be a crime. However, when it's done on an international level, it is not a crime. And this is exactly what we do.
Of course, some of these tools are crimes, Mr. Perkins. You write that the tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. With the possible exception of sex, the rest are definitely crimes. Are these things not prosecuted? How does an economic hitman commit murder, for example, the most severe, and get away with it?
Well, the other things, let's get back to murder in just a minute. But all the other things, the fraudulent financial reports, the rigged elections, and so on, are perhaps they're crimes, but only if they can be proven to have happened. In my experience, and I had a cadre of very qualified economists working for me. My job was to go into these countries and strike deals with them around these loans, and then I would go back to my economists, and they would develop econometric models and reports that showed that the deal that I had struck was the best one for serving that country. So it wasn't really about doing good economic studies. It was about setting up deals and then having economic studies justify those deals.
In other words, you make the deal first, and then you develop the economics later that's supposed to be objective and point them in the direction of the deal you've already made.
Right, and you could certainly say that that's a fraudulent approach. However, the possibility of being caught in that approach is extremely difficult. And if we were caught at it, we could simply say that, well, we didn't do a very good economic study. We made some major mistakes. Sorry.
Did the countries realize that the same people doing the economic projections were the same people who did the deals, or did they think they were independent people?
The people at the top of the countries did. Now, you know, it's hard when you talk about a country because, in fact, we're screwing most of the world in doing this, and we're screwing most American citizens in this process, too. But the people at the top of the system, whether it's in a third world country or in our own country, they realize what's going on. They're part of the deal. Most everybody else doesn't realize it. Except nowadays, increasingly around the world, I'm finding that people in these third world countries suspect, they strongly suspect that this is going on. They know, they read in newspapers or hear on the radio that their country has just received a $1 billion loan from the World Bank, and they see that their lives don't get any better from this. They see that a few families in their country, the ones who own the John Deere franchises and the big industries, are benefiting. They see American companies in there building the projects, making a lot of money, and they also see that they just get deeper and deeper into debt. So they're really beginning to understand how corrupt this system is. Unfortunately, most Americans don't. Most Americans believe that foreign aid is altruistic. And for the most part, it is not altruistic.
Well, we've talked a lot about generalities. I want to get to specifics because one of the best parts about your book, of course, is the details. Specifics on Panama, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Ecuador. There are really a lot of interesting things. Halliburton is an example. I also want to get to some calls. If you want to call in and ask Mr. Perkins questions, this is your chance to grill a former economic hitman. All you have to do is pick up the phone and dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or if you want to write your comments down, you can post them on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. I'll be reading some of your comments in just a minute. Let me go to the phones. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and John Perkins.
Hey, Mark, it's Dave, and I called you early today because, once again, I'm not permitted to listen to you on the Internet. But
yeah, I don't know what's with your computer, Dave.
Oh,
but go,
I know.
Go ahead. Ask your question.
Yes, I wanted to tell me, Hitmans, John, did you – this goes back quite a ways, doesn't it? You're not saying this just started with Bush.
No, not at all. It's not a partisan issue. It happens under the Democratic regimes and Republican both.
Because, you know, I can certainly picture it with Bush Jr. and Sr. and probably with Reagan, but, it doesn't seem like something Carter would have gone along with. And
Lyndon Johnson certainly did. I mean, I know the Dominican Republic, for example, Lyndon Johnson did something there. I don't know about Jimmy Carter. Mr. Perkins?
It's a little known fact, but the corporations became very powerful under Carter. He did a lot to help corporations. We have to remember that he was not a little peanut farmer from Georgia. He was a multimillionaire peanut farmer from Georgia. And I like the man. I think he was a very integrous man in many respects. But he very much helped the corporatocracy. And you also have to – do you remember who his equivalent to Condoleezza Rice in her old job at the National
Security Council? Zbigniew Brzezinski, I think, right?
Yeah, Brzezinski, who was one of the most – draconian people, advisors that any president ever had.
So let me ask you, because I think Jimmy Carter, I mean, one of the things he did, of course, was he withdrew support for the Shah of Iran at a crucial time before his fall. Some have criticized him for that, saying that, he was a vicious dictator who tortured his own people, but he was our vicious dictator who tortured his own people, and Carter shouldn't have withdrawn support for the Shah. Maybe you could tell me more specifically what happened then in 1979. Were you involved in Iran in any way at that time?
I was very involved. In fact, I was smuggled out of Iran just before it happened. I tell this story in detail in the book. Before I would have gotten into trouble by being there. I worked for the Shah of Iran. I'm not proud of the fact, but it happened. And, the Shah was a ruthless dictator. Now, if you go back to 1951, Iran democratically elected a premier named Mossadegh, and he was held out as the great hope for democracy around the world. In fact, Time magazine featured him as their man of the year in 1951. Then he began to clamp down on international oil companies, and saying that they needed to return more of their profits to the Iranian people, that they were holding out 85% of their profits for themselves, more of it needed to come back to Iran. And we strongly objected to that. We did not dare go to war with Iran. We didn't dare send in troops because at that point, early 50s, we were very afraid of the growing power of the Soviet Union, and Iran is on the border of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union had nuclear weapons. So did we. We didn't want a nuclear war. So we decided to try a new tactic. We sent in a CIA agent whose name was Kermit Roosevelt. He was Teddy's grandson. We sent him in with a few million dollars, and in a fairly short amount of time, he managed to overthrow this democratically elected premier, Mossadegh, and replace him with the brutal, despotic Shah.
That was Eisenhower's time, right? Just to be clear?
Yeah, it was.
I thought it happened after Truman. I happen to like Harry Truman, so I just wanted to make that clear. Go ahead.
Truman refused to do this.
Okay, there we go. More reason why I like Truman.
It began under Truman, and the British asked Truman to help do this, and he refused.
Okay.
When Eisenhower came in, and the Dulles brothers were basically running the CIA and the State Department under Eisenhower, and they were very, very strong anti-Soviet, anti-communist forces. And they were the ones who really pressed Eisenhower to do this. Your history is real good, Mark. You get this down.
Well, let me move on to the 70s, though, because Jimmy Carter is an interesting figure in history. You can argue a lot of people consider him a failed president, particularly domestically. But in foreign policy, Jimmy Carter at least talked a lot about human rights, far more than almost any president of our time. And the general conception, I think, is historical, and it may not be accurate, as you seem to be telling us, is that Jimmy Carter was more concerned about human rights than most, and that's why he withdrew support from the Shah in the 70s. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with all that, and I think the irony of the Carter administration was that I think Jimmy Carter was a very principled guy, believed in all these things, but when you come right down to it, this country is run by the corporatocracy. It's not run by the president. There's a lot of evidence that indicates that one of the reasons Carter became president was because the conservatives and the Republicans knew that after Nixon's debacle with Watergate, et cetera, no Republican was going to be elected. Ford would not be elected. And therefore, they helped orchestrate a Democratic candidate that they knew they could handle.
And do you think they handled Jimmy Carter?
Yeah.
Can you give me some examples specifically with regard to Iran of how they handled Carter?
Well, yeah, if you remember, I mean, at that point, the real downfall of Carter was the fact that 52 hostages were taken when the U.S. embassy was overrun.
Yeah, I always was amazed by the fact that here we have, for example, 1,400 Americans dead in Iraq, tens of thousands wounded, and yet somehow the 52 hostages in Iran you've stymied our policy for 4 years, but 1,000 deaths don't do it. I never quite understood how the media kept harping on that, but go ahead, please.
Well, I think it was time to get Carter out. I think at this point, this was used as a means to get Carter out. Carter was not a very astute politician. He was not able to control the press in the way that other presidents have been able to do so. And so this became a huge factor, and I agree with you, it probably shouldn't have been a huge factor. The Shah should not have been defended, although I worked for him for many years.
Let me ask you this question, and maybe I'm playing a bit of devil's advocate here. I'll admit that. Usually I state my own views, but now I'll tell you, I'm sort of stating the typical neocon view. Why not protect dictators that help American interests? I believe it was, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt that said of Anastasio Somoza in Nicaragua, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. Mm. Wasn't that Roosevelt?
Why,
given that we have these awful dictators that exist around the world and we can't always make them Democrats, why not at least support the ones like the Shah, who, awful as he is helping America?
Because the Shah, there's a philosophical answer. First of all, the Shah was hated by his people.
Sure.
Why support somebody that's hated by his people? Philosophically, we believe in democracy. We're a country that believes in government of the people, for the people, and by the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations, or of the dictator, for the dictator, by the dictator. That's stated in our policy. We say that we support democracies around the world. We should support democracies around the world. That's what we should be doing. That's from a philosophical standpoint, rather than supporting dictators that are hated within their own countries. The practical standpoint is that in the process of supporting these despotic governments, we've managed to alienate a great deal of the world. I just came back from Tibet and Nepal about 5 months ago, and just 2 weeks ago I was in Brazil, and I was in South America, I was in the Caribbean. I've never known a time when Americans were so detested, or our policy was, not us as individuals. We were so feared, and so we are so feared and so despised, and people are very angry at us. So from our own self-interest, I have a 22-year-old daughter. I want to see her inherit a world that doesn't hate us the way it hates us right now. And I want to see our own country stand up for its own principles. If when we stand up for our own principles and when we try to help the rest of the world have the opportunity to live by the same principles, then we'll be in a safe world. The world we have created in our own country today is very much like the empire that we fought against when we fought the British in the 1770s. We defeated the British, and now, in the last half of this last century, we've managed to create something much more powerful and in a way much more despotic than the British Empire ever was.
Dave, have we answered your questions?
Yes, thank you so much for letting me hang on and listen. I think the lesson that it's the corporatists running the government rather than the reverse, there are those of us that feel that Kennedy learned that the hard way.
I think you could make a good point. I don't like to speculate. I like to talk about actual experiences I've had, and I don't have any experience there. But I think that our presidents are very much under the control of the corporatocracy. And when you get a president like Bush, for example, who's very much in bed with the corporatocracy, his whole family has been for many years, then you've got a synergy that goes on. When you've got presidents like Kennedy and Carter, for example, who may have tried to oppose the corporatocracy, you've got friction. And in the end, the corporatocracy wins out one way or another.
Dave, thank you very much for
your
call.
Thank you, both of you.
It's interesting to me, of course, that Eisenhower, who overturned a democratically elected leader in Iran by the end of his 8 years of the presidency, was already complaining about the military-industrial complex, which I think is probably just another name for the corporatocracy. We got a lot more to talk about. If you want to call in, all you have to do is pick up the phone, dial toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP. We've talked a lot about generalities, but I like details, so I'm going to come back after the break. I'm going to ask Mr. Perkins about Saudi Arabia, about Iraq. Why are we in Iraq? I've always wanted to know that. What happened in Panama? What did Dick Cheney do? What did George Bush do? Can you argue that either of them are economic hitmen themselves? Feel free to call in 877-57-SCOOP or comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
Thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to 4 real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And surely, the government does not want you to know about the secret and nefarious world of the economic hitman, the corporate government agents who work around the globe to promote American interests, sometimes by getting third world countries to sign on to loans that they know they can't pay back, sometimes using extreme measures such as rigged elections, extortion, sex, and murder. And how do we know this? Well, we know it partly because of history and partly because of our guest, John Perkins, a former economic hitman who has come out and of the shadows to talk with us today. His book is number 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and John Perkins.
Hi, Mark. This is Ed from New York, and I've got two questions for John Perkins, if I can.
Go ahead.
I want to know, first, what is the connection between the World Bank and the corporatocracy, as he described it? And the second is, where did Bill Clinton fit into this particular thing? Was he part of the same deal of people who were going ahead and rewarding corporations through the World Bank?
Two great questions. Hang on, Ed. Let's let John answer.
Thanks, Ned. First of all, the World Bank is a tool of the corporatocracy and the economic hitmen. We use it extensively to get at its money to help our corporations get a lot more wealthy and powerful. And basically, the way the bank is set up, the president is always from the United States. The United States controls over a little over 16% of the stock of the World Bank. The next largest country is Japan with 8%, roughly half what we have. Then the G7 countries control another 12 or so percent. We have complete control, really, when you come right down to it, over the way the bank works, and we use it extensively. What was the second question?
Second question was Bill Clinton. Is he part of the corporatocracy?
I was out of the system at that point in the 90s. I was running a nonprofit organization helping indigenous people in many of the countries that I'd ripped off, trying to assuage some of my guilt. So I can't really speak from any personal experience, but I don't like to speculate too much, but I would suggest that I think Clinton was really cut off at the knees during his first term when he and Hillary tried to make some changes in the health and Social Security systems, and I think Clinton very quickly got the message that he needed to play the game along with the corporatocracy in order to stay in power. And maybe he overstepped his bounds a little bit, and that's why so much was made of Monica Lewinsky. I don't know. I have to say that's pure speculation. And in my book, I don't speculate at all. It's all based on actual experience, and I had none with the Clinton administration.
Well, speaking of your actual experiences, there are a lot of stories in the book, and I want to give our listeners some indication of what they will find in the book. I don't know which story is your favorite. There's the one about you providing a escort for a Saudi sheikh. I thought that was interesting. There's stories about Bush and the Saudis and helping Iraq. I don't know. Pick one of your most interesting economic hitman stories and share it with our listeners.
Well, I think in a way the Saudi Arabia story, it sheds the most light on what's happening in Iraq today, which is on everybody's mind.
Okay. Please, go ahead.
In the early 70s, as some of your listeners may be old enough to remember, that the United States economy was practically brought to its knees by OPEC, who flexed its muscle and it shut down a lot of supplies of oil. We had cars lined up at the gas stations. We were afraid that we were going to go through another depression like that of 1929. And so the U.S. Treasury Department came to me and other hitmen and said, you know, this is unacceptable. You've got to come up with a plan so that this can never happen again. Well, we knew the key to that plan would be Saudi Arabia. It had more oil than any country in the world, and its government, the House of Saud, was corrupt and corruptible. And so it's a long story, and there's a lot in the book about this, including the pimping that you referred to with the Saudi princes. But to summarize it, we struck a deal with the House of Saud whereby they would reinvest most of their petrodollars, the money they earned from oil, back into U.S. government securities, came back into our country. The interest from those securities was given to the State Department to use to hire U.S. corporations to build Saudi Arabia in a Western image. We built desalinization plants and highways and ports and power plants. In fact, we built huge cities out of the desert. And the House of Saud also agreed to maintain the price of oil within limits acceptable to us, and we agreed to keep the House of Saud in power. That deal has held throughout all these years. Getting a little shaky now because the House of Saud is very unpopular right now in Saudi Arabia and throughout the Muslim world.
How does that deal with Saudi Arabia affect us on September 11th? How does that? Is there any connection there?
Yes, I think there's a very strong connection. First of all, Osama bin Laden is extremely angry with the House of Saud because, in his opinion, they sold out Saudi Arabia. And today the most sacred cities or locations in the Islamic world, Medina and Mecca, are essentially surrounded by, you know, westernized cities, McDonald's, etc. The conservative Muslims around the world, including Osama bin Laden, are very angry about this. Also, of course, Osama bin Laden was financed by the House of Saud. One of their ways of trying to keep him on their side, that they financed him for years with our approval in the case of Afghanistan. In any case, this plan was so successful in Saudi Arabia that we thought we would do the same thing in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. And so in the 80s, the economic hitmen went into Iraq and tried to convince Saddam Hussein to do exactly what Saudi Arabia had done, or something very similar.
And this would be the time in the Reagan administration when Don Rumsfeld was sent as a special envoy to shake Saddam Hussein's hand, when we established diplomatic relations right after Saddam Hussein gassed a number of Kurds and so forth. This would be this time, the 80s?
Yes, okay. Exactly, throughout the 80s. But Saddam did not buy. And so the second line of defense, always when the economic hitmen fail, is that we send in what we call the jackals, CIA-sanctioned assassins. They tried to take out Saddam Hussein.
Really? We tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein?
Oh, absolutely.
When was this?
During the 80s, a number of times during the 80s.
Interesting.
But Saddam, and I tell in the book about how I had been involved with Jaime Roldos of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama, trying to bring them around into the economic hitmen fold. They didn't come, and so the jackals were sent in there, and both of those two presidents were assassinated on my watch. I was very familiar with that one.
Well, now let me get this straight. You're saying that General Torrijos of Panama, he went down in a plane crash, right? Are you saying that the CIA caused that?
Yes, and there's a tremendous amount of evidence that was an assassination. A small tape recorder was handed to him just before he got on the plane, which later was discovered that it had an explosive device in it. Same with Jaime Roldos 3 months before Torrijos, whose helicopter blew up as it took off in southern Ecuador. These were two men who strongly opposed the corporatocracy, and it was my job to bring them around. I couldn't. I failed at it.
Did you personally talk to General Torrijos, try to bring him around?
Yes, and I go into detail in the book about that conversation.
Tell me a little bit about it. I have to admit, my producer's read your book in full. I should tell you this. I have skimmed your book, and I like it. I will read it, but tell me what about your conversation with Torrijos, just to give an example of the kind of work you used to do.
Well, Torrijos called me into this little bungalow house that he was staying in outside Panama City, and we sat there for a long time, and he told me, look, I know what you're trying to do. I know you're the game that you guys are playing, and I know that if I play along with the game, I'll become fabulously wealthy. I'm not interested in that. I want to help my poor people in this country. And so you're either going to play the game my way and help my poor people, or you can get out of the country. I went back to my bosses in Boston and told them this, and we all agreed that, well, let's play along with him for now. We might as well stay in the country, even though we're not doing it the way that we're supposed to be doing it. In fact, under him, we got loans from the Inter-American Development Bank that did very good things in Panama. We really did help the poor people, the rural farmers, the small fishing industry, et cetera. We did some very good work there. We proved that foreign aid can do what it's supposed to do. But at the same time, I knew that Torrijos was in trouble, because whenever a government official like him, the whole system is based on the assumption that these officials are corruptible. And if one of them is not corruptible, not only does he ruin the plans for that country, but he also sets an example which could serve as a bad precedent for many other leaders. And at the same time that Torrijos was doing this in Panama, Jaime Roldos was first democratically elected president of Ecuador after many years of military dictatorships. And he was clamping down on the oil companies. He'd run on a platform that said, I want the oil to benefit my people, the Ecuadorians, not just the oil companies. As soon as he became president, he began to institute policies to get the oil companies to share a lot more of their wealth with the Ecuadorians. Again, we economic hitmen tried to convince him otherwise. He wouldn't buy. So in both these cases, I was aware that these men's lives were in deep jeopardy. They were not only destroying our plans in their countries, but they were serving as a dangerous example. And so sure enough, in 1981, both of them died in these fiery helicopter or airplane crashes that had all the markings of CIA-sanctioned assassinations.
Well, let me ask you this, because I know I have lots of skeptical listeners. I have people of all different ideological stripes who listen to this radio show, and I guarantee you some of them are going to write on this blog. I can see it now because I know what they do. This is ridiculous. Your guest is a conspiracy theorist. It's ridiculous to say the CIA killed these men. Where could someone go, if they still had an open mind, and some people don't have an open mind, to prove what you've just said, which, after all, is an extraordinary allegation? Where would be the best evidence to look up?
It's not at all an unusual allegation. Throughout South America, this is well known, and there's a lot of references at the end of those chapters in my book.
Okay.
I provide lots of references. Practically everyone that investigated these two accidents came to the conclusion that those planes were blown up. Now, nobody ever proved that it was the CIA. And, in fact, in this day and age, there are no 007s out there that work for the government. All of that sort of work is done by independent contractors, most of whom have come out of the military or the CIA, but no longer work for it, in the same way that I didn't officially work for the government. So I'm not saying that CIA agents went in and did this. I'm saying they were CIA sanctioned.
I see.
And it's tremendous proof about this throughout.
And that's an important distinction. A lot of people say, well, the United States didn't give chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein. No, but they allowed American companies to do exactly the same things.
Not just allow, but encourage.
Okay.
And sanction. There's a lot of reference. Everything that I talk about in the book, incidentally, Mark, is highly referenced. Other people have written about it. I tell my personal story, but you can't really refute the facts. I mean, they're out there. They're public record, including the fact that these planes blew up under very, very suspicious circumstances.
Mr. Perkins, we have to go to another commercial break. When we come back, I want to go a little bit more personal and ask you the question that I know is on a lot of listeners' minds. It's a moral question. How could you have done this? And then the reverse question, how did you come out and see the light and change your whole moral view, which I suppose it took? And related to that question is the question of our current president and vice president and whether you consider them economic hitmen. But I want you to think about that and respond after the commercial break. If you want to call in and ask questions like these or any you have of your own, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
The doctor. doctor the other day.
Oh, good, but my cholesterol's 200. It's a little high.
Yeah, I'm around 760.
760? You're kidding me!
Pretty impressive, huh?
No, not impressive. Not impressive at all. What are you, on some sort of butter diet?
Yeah, you know, I figured at 760, getting a loan on the new car should be no problem.
Loan? What are you talking about, man? You're not going to live long enough to pay back a loan.
There's physical health, and then there's financial health. With Score Power from Equifax, you'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for just $14.95. It's the first step toward healthy credit, and a score of 760 is pretty healthy. So check out Score Power at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Yeah, I figure I can get up to around 790 by the end of the year, you know, if I'm lucky.
Look, a little advice.
Yeah?
Eat a vegetable, a smoothie, something, man.
Get the power. Score Power at Equifax.com.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec, nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get Score Power from Equifax.com. Score Power gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get Score Power at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. Score Power.
Reach for the stars.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. And certainly the government does not want you to know about John Perkins, who is a former economic hitman. And even more extraordinary than that, he's someone who is confessing, who is has turned the other cheek, as it will, to fight against the same things that he practiced. His book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, is in the top 10 list on the New York Times bestseller list, number 4 on Amazon.com. And if you want to call in, all you have to do is dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP or write on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Got a comment here from Rick on the blog. Rick writes, "The United States has been doing this sort of thing since we became a country. Maybe I wouldn't feel so bad about this sort of thing if it was really to make the world a better place. It's not about making the world a better place. It's about solidifying corporate power and wealth, at least in my opinion. You go to these countries and almost, if not in all occasions, there are huge American companies exploiting the people and natural resources of the region. I'll tell you this. It has nothing to do with promoting freedom." Rick, I think you're right on. I do want to ask John Perkins the difficult question, I think more difficult actually than reciting his experiences, and that is, I guess, the negative question, how, John, could you have done such a thing? And then the more positive question, what made you change your mind about what you used to do?
Good questions, Mark. First of all, how could I have done such a thing? It's not illegal what I did, for the most part. It's sanctioned by business schools. I was patted on the back by men like Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank. I was lauded. I lectured at Harvard and all at universities and colleges around the world about what I did. And still, business schools support this sort of thing. They say that, you know, if you can increase the gross national product of a developing country, you're doing it a big favor. The truth of them, and we did that, usually. And the truth of the matter is, you often increase the gross national product of a country and make only a few very families in that country who own most of the resources in that country very rich, while everybody else gets a lot poorer. So, in my heart, I knew what I was doing was wrong. It was easy to intellectualize that what I was doing was right. I think we all do that to a large degree. I'm not trying to make excuses for myself, but I think everybody who asks that kind of question really needs to look at, well, you know, what do you do in your purchasing habits, the car you drive, the number of times you fly an airplane, da-da-da-da-da. You know, we all justify things. And I think that's one of the very difficult things about the system we're living in right now and why it's difficult sometimes to turn it around, because we've all become so dependent on these big corporations for our food, our medicines, our supplies, our salaries, et cetera, our insurance, whatever.
Well, Mr. Perkins, how did you come to turn it around and actually tell on all the various companies that you used to work for?
Well, it took a long time,
sure.
Unfortunately. And when it really struck me was at 9/11. I went, was in the Amazon on 9/11, but shortly afterwards I went up to Ground Zero. And as I stood there at that smoldering pit, I realized that I absolutely had to tell this story. I have a 22-year-old daughter. I just turned 60. I want to devote the rest of my life to making this a better world for her and her generation around the world and their children. And I realized that I had to take a lot of responsibility for what happened to 9/11. That although Osama bin Laden is a terrible mass murderer, unfortunately, much of the world looks at him as a sort of hero, as a kind of a Robin Hood or David standing up to Goliath. Because so much of the world is very angry, 24,000 people die every single day of starvation. 30,000 children die every day from curable diseases because they don't get medicines. 80% of the world only receives 10% of the medicines. I mean, and so we've got over 50,000 people every single day dying painful, terrible deaths needlessly. And a lot of this is happening not just because we're indifferent, but because the policies of the corporation actually promote systems that support this sort of activity.
Let me go to the phones if I can. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and John Perkins.
Caller,
yes, go ahead.
My question is...
You want to say your name and where you're from, please?
Sure. My name is Mark. I am from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Great.
And I understand that Mr. Perkins feels guilty about what he's done in the past, but I'm wondering, what's he going to do with... Sorry. What's he going to do with the money that he's getting from this book? Is he going to apply that to the people that he harmed? Or what's he going to do with the money that he took as bribes or the salary that he earned?
That's a fair, tough question. Mr. Perkins?
It's a good question. It's not tough at all. I took, as I say in the book, a $500,000 bribe in the early 90s. Most of that I put toward a nonprofit organization which is set up to help indigenous people in some of the countries that we ripped off, and also set up to help educate people in this country. You can learn more about it if you go to dreamchange.org. That's the name of the nonprofit. I'm not looking to buy myself a private jet or yacht or get rich off this book. The money from this book will go towards spreading this word. It'll go towards supporting the activities of these nonprofit organizations and my own activities in spreading this word. Tomorrow I leave on a tour to speak to universities in many parts of the country. I wanted to reach out more to young people. This book is about helping my daughter's generation learn and creating a safer and more just world. It's not about me getting rich, believe me. I have no desire for that anymore.
Do you want to make a further comment, Mark, or does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, I just would say that, you know, I did some searching on the web, and I think the biggest question is, like, when you see a book like this, it's very interesting, but you always ask about credibility. And so I'm just wondering, maybe I would just suggest that he make it more available on the web, or maybe on his website, all this information that he's giving.
Well, I don't understand what the information is in the book. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, since the money's going to a nonprofit, Mark, I guess the information is in the book.
Right. But, see, the thing is that I have to buy the book before I even look at it, before I even know that information. All I can know is from what I see on Amazon or on, you know, his website.
Well, Ms. Perkins, where can someone who is skeptical, like our listener here, but wants to find out more of what you talk about, find objective, I don't know if there's anything objective left in America, but let's try, objective sources to describe and explain some of the things you talk about?
Well, every chapter in the book is very well referenced, and yeah, maybe you got to buy the book, or maybe you want to wait till it comes out in paperback, which it will in a year and a half or so. You know, I mean, I write books. I can't spend my life on the internet, you know, trying to justify what I write in the books. I just can't do that. But the information is all there in the book, and I would suggest people go to that or come and hear me speak and ask me directly. I'm speaking at a lot of places. You can go to that website, dreamchange.org, or you can go to a website, johnperkins.org, and find out my schedule. I'm in Michigan and Wisconsin next week, and then I'm in the New York area, and I'm traveling around.
Yeah, unfortunately not North Carolina.
Well, Mark, I'll tell you.
We welcome you down here.
Okay. Well, thanks for your call, Mark. I'll tell you this. The things that I know of what John Perkins speaks, namely, I know about the coup in Iran, Mossadegh. I know about how much we supported Saddam Hussein. I know how much we supported Saudi Arabia. Everything he said has rang true to me. I don't happen to know personally some of the details he mentions in Panama, but at least I can vouch for the things that I know of that I've seen documented in other sources. Thanks very much for your call, Mark.
I appreciate that.
I do want to close. We still got about 10 minutes left. So actually, we can take one more call if you want to call in. The lines are open, 877-57-SCOOP. But, Mr. Perkins, I want to ask you about George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. In many ways, Dick Cheney, the CEO of Halliburton, is, more of a major economic figure than George W. Bush, although George W. Bush also has received aid through Harkin Energy and some other things in Saudi Arabia. Let me ask you, do you consider our current vice president and president, either or both, to be economic hitmen? I mean, has Dick Cheney profited by dealing with these dictators, or is that too strong a term for them?
No, that's not too strong a term, and to say that Dick Cheney's profited is an understatement.
Okay, why don't you give us some details?
Well, you know, I mean, he was...
I know, but my listeners may not know.
He was president of Halliburton. He still, as I understand, owns a great deal of stock. It may be in a trust. It's kind of hidden. I'm sure he's profiting very much by these activities. To call him an economic hitman, you know, is to call a king a knight. I would say that we economic hitmen are the soldiers. We're like the knights. It's the Dick Cheneys of the world that are running us, that are running this whole process. They are the corporatocracy. And it's not just Democrats. I mean, excuse me, Republicans. Please, I'm not at all saying that. And this is not a political issue. It happens under the Democrats as much as under the Republicans. Most of the presidents, including, I think, the Bushes, have been pretty much like, you know, the high level of the knights in this situation. I think presidents who stand up to the corporatocracy get into trouble and eventually are brought around. The Bush family has been very much a part of it, so they've worked hand in glove with the corporatocracy.
Let me go to another caller. Call, you're on the line with Mark Levine and John Perkins.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Mr. Perkins.
What's your name?
I had actually posted... this is Rod from New York.
Hi, Rod from New York. Go ahead.
Hi. I had posted something on the blog, and I had this question to ask, so let me make it as fast.
Go right ahead.
I want to know if Mr. Perkins believes that it is enough to read for the American public to read the exploits and confessions of a self-confessed economic hitman. I mean, are we better off just trying to work the system as it stands? Because we don't get to vote anymore, as has been proven by the last two elections. The corporatocracy has made their way into elections.
How do we stop these economic hitmen, John Perkins? Is that the heart of your question, Ron?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we as progressives, liberals, Democrats, however you want to name us, the rest of us really have no leverage in their world.
Yeah, I'm sure glad that George Washington and Tom Paine didn't take that attitude back in the 1770s. I'm sure glad that Martin Luther King didn't take that attitude. I'm sure glad that the women suffragettes didn't take that attitude. I'm sure glad that all those playwrights and union leaders and poets in the Soviet Union in the 80s didn't take that attitude.
Solid point, but what can we do, Mr.
Perkins? We have a great deal of power. And we've seen this time and time again in this country and in other places. The corporatocracy, the corporations, are very vulnerable. And you can look at many examples of when organizations like Rainforest Action Network have boycotted certain products, organizations like Home Depot. They change their policies, these corporations. We need to speak out. We need not to be afraid to speak out at every chance we get. We don't need to be argumentative with everybody. You know, talk to your mother-in-law, talk to your father and brother and sister and everybody over dinner about these things. It doesn't need to be confrontational, but get people to raise the questions. Get people to talk. This is all about education.
And, hey, listen to the Inside Scoop and get your facts so that you know what to argue.
Exactly. Radio stations
like... I'm sorry to interrupt, but you'd say specifically boycotts? That kind of thing, and I guess educating people as to what they're up to.
Well, yeah, okay. Rod's skeptical, Mr. Perkins. He doesn't think that's enough. I mean, we do a few boycotts. How does that really stop them?
Well, it has changed amazing policies in the last few years. We've seen amazing things happen in the environmental field. We haven't seen a lot happen in the political field because we haven't really gone after it. We need to a lot more. The World Bank has been greatly impacted by what happened in Seattle in 1999. Believe me, I know a lot of people there.
Well, that's interesting.
I was just at the World Social Forum in Brazil. 155,000 people attended. The world is sitting up and taking notice of this. You may not feel it. What I hear in the skepticism of this listener is, you know, it didn't happen yesterday. It didn't happen in the last 2 years. Therefore, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. History isn't quite that fast. Things are happening. People are buying this book. They're calling into this show. A lot of people are listening to this show and other shows. We can turn this around, but we've got to work together. Join other like-minded people. Join civil movements. Support nonprofit organizations. Get behind people that are doing things and put your energy into it.
Rod, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins.
And incidentally, I do want to add that in the book there's quite a few specific things of what people can do. But ultimately, what you do has to be independent upon your own abilities and your own passion. So, you know, I can provide a laundry list, but you have to select what it is that really appeals to you.
Thanks again. I'll tell you, you know, I've done some of that myself, as my listeners know. I used to be a fairly highly paid trial attorney, and now I'm a fairly lowly paid radio host. But I did it because I felt that I needed to give the inside scoop on what's going on, to have people like you, Mr. Perkins, on the show. It's interesting that you mentioned the World Trade Organization riot in Seattle. In fact, I've got a blogger right here named Skip, who was interested precisely in that point. Skip is saying he was oblivious to what the riot was all about when it happened. How do you see it fitting into the big picture? Skip wants to know.
Well, I know that a lot of people in the World Bank and corporations were highly affected by that. We've got to remember that there's tens of thousands of people in these organizations that are blindsiding themselves, pulling the wool over their own eyes. They don't know what's going on. They're not exactly part of the system. They're just kind of going along with it because it's easy to, because they've got what they consider to be good lives. But when something like this, the 1999 thing in Seattle happened, it forces them to really look at themselves, and that's always very, very good.
I'll tell you, we only have a couple minutes left, and it may be a tough question for a couple minutes, but partly relates to a blog comment by Gordon and partly a comment actually by my own producer, and that is how third world countries are fighting back. One of the things that Gordon points out, and I think it's a fair point, is we for decades used heavy debt to bring third world nations in line doing what we want to do. Now that we have heavy debt, the United States has heavy debt to countries like China and Saudi Arabia, does it mean that, in fact, they can control us? And related to that question, I know we've only got about a minute to respond, do you think that OPEC, by moving from the dollar to the euro, is also fighting back and starting to control us?
If OPEC did move from the dollar to the euro, yes, it could do that. Saddam Hussein threatened to do that. That's one of the reasons we went after him, one of them. A lot of countries are opposing us. Six countries in Latin America in their last election voted in the president that opposed the United States and our corporate policies. Chile, Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Uruguay all voted in presidents, and they're and many of those countries are refusing to pay these debts, saying they're not legitimate debts.
What about the debts we owe? Does that make us controlled by other countries?
No, because as long as the other countries will accept the dollar and we print the dollar without a gold standard or any other standard, we're not controlled by other countries. If the world should move, or if OPEC should move to the euro, then we'd be in trouble.
So what happens if China says we want to be paid back? We just print more dollars, cause more inflation?
Exactly.
I see. Well, Mr. Perkins, it's been a fascinating interview. Your book is very interesting. The book is John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It is on the top 10 list. And to my caller in North Carolina, Mr. Perkins tells us he is donating all the, am I correct, all the funds from the book?
The funds from all the profits. The ones that I get, the money that I get from the book is going to go to promoting these causes.
That's terrific. So you don't have to worry about spending your hard-earned dollar. Thank you very much for spending an hour with us. It really flew by. Mr. Perkins, you were a terrific guest here on The Inside Scoop.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for all the good work you're doing, Mark.
Thank you. Tomorrow is Debate Tuesday. I'm inviting back a former guest on The Inside Scoop. He's Tom Robbins. He's the state chair of the Utah College Republicans. Tomorrow's show, of course, is televised on Channel 10 in Northern Virginia. But Tom Robbins is in town, so you can watch him.